hppodcraft.com.
There was nobody in the orchard. Harriet Lee went out, carefully through the iron gate into the field. She had made the latch slip into its notch without a sound. The path slanted widely up the field from the orchard gate to the stile under the elder tree. George Waring waited for her there. Years afterwards, when she thought of George Waring, she smelt the sweet, hot wine scent of the elderflowers. Years afterwards, when she smelt elderflowers, she saw George Waring with his beautiful, gentle face, like a poet's or a musician's, his black blue eyes and sleek olive brown hair. He was a naval lieutenant. Yesterday he had asked her to marry him and she had consented, but her father hadn't. And she'd come to tell him that and say goodbye before he left her. His ship was to sail the next day.
Oh man, this is a different kind of horror story, but still, very horrifying. That was the opening of Where Their Fire Is Not Quenched by Mason Clare.
I have to admit, I read that opening and thought, uh-oh, is this going to be some bummer breakup ghost story? We got this from that creepy attic book, as with all stories this month. Yeah. And so, real quick, I jumped out and I flipped to the table of contents to read the synopsis before proceeding. Mm-hmm. And it says, Where Their Fire Is Not Quenched by Mason Clare, a modern conception of hell and the retribution for sins, in which the reader's sympathies go out to the anguished lovers in their perpetual torment. And I thought, oh good, not a bummer at all. Oh, man.
That sounds pretty bad.
At least there's the promise of sin. I guess that was my consolation, which, okay, as you know, I find delectable. I'm Chad Pfeiffer, by the way.
And I am Chris Lackey.
We're here at Strange Studies of Strange Stories, a.k.a. the H.P. Lovecraft Literary Podcast, always here for you on Patreon.
Our reader is 9-time world champion podcast reader, Rachel Lackey.
9 times now.
She's won 9 times, yeah.
Wow.
Out of 14.
You'd think she'd take herself out of the running at this point, but...
No, her ego won't let her.
Yeah, I know. She never makes the classy move, that one. It's just pure ego. Give me more.
You can hear her explore the exciting world of late 80s and early 90s sci-fi with Rachel Watches Star Trek.
What's the deal with this author? I don't know Mason Clare.
We have never covered Mason Clare on our show before, and she was a very intriguing woman. Born Mary Amelia St. Clare in 1863 in Cheshire, England. She was the daughter of a strict religious woman and a father who was a ship owner in Liverpool, went bankrupt, became an alcoholic, and died when she was very young.
Apparently, I guess they wanted to raise a writer. Baby Einstein to raise a scientist, drunk bankruptcy to raise a writer, I think is how the old rhyme goes.
Yes. Did it rhyme in Dutch originally?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Her family moved to London and she did go to school but had to drop out to look after her 4 older brothers who were all suffering from fatal congenital heart disease, which is crazy. And they died within 4 or 5 years of each other, her 4 brothers. It was nuts.
So brutal.
Now, she did have a bond/mentorship with the head teacher of the school, Dorothea Beale, and she noticed Sinclair's talent. It says, she encouraged Sinclair's intellectual aspirations and consolidated her emerging sense of herself as a thinker, a woman of ideas. And she wrote professionally to support her family, which is crazy. And she was an active feminist and suffragette. She wrote for the Cheltenham Ladies College magazine between 1882 and 1898. She would have been 19 years old when she started.
Really intelligent person. We do so many of these author bios. It's usually they had to clerk at a public utility and write on their lunch break from jail for some reason because they offended a king. But it's just always strange when someone takes up writing as a means to support their family.
Yeah, that's crazy.
This is like vampires eating hair or something. I'm like, what? I didn't expect that. This is breaking the tropes of sad author bios.
Yeah. 1893, she met a vicar, Anthony Dean. They would often debate philosophy and religion, and she was agnostic, and he would always try to bring her back into the Christianity fold. It's believed they had a serious, perhaps romantic relationship. Not sure. It's not documented anywhere. But in 1896, Dean was married to someone else.
If she did ever confess this to somebody, though, you know what it would sound like? She would have said, I love Dean. I love him. This sounds really sinful, man. So like I said, I was encouraged by sin at the beginning, and here it is. I was a big fan of the Thornbirds miniseries growing up.
Yeah.
I like a good affair with a man of the cloth.
Sinclair moved to London and got her first novel published in 1897. It was called Audrey Craven. In 1904, she published The Divine Fire, and that was the novel that made her famous. It was such a big hit. It was huge in America. She went on a tour, and she was hosted on this tour by people like Ralph Waldo Emerson and Mark Twain.
Wow.
So she was a big deal. She had a relationship with author Thomas Hardy, but it never became what she had hoped it was going to be. Like, they went on like a bike ride trip together across southern England.
Oh, yeah?
For days. Yeah, it's really strange. Maybe she had an affair with him. She didn't write about it, so nobody knows if they actually had an affair. But I mean, if you're going on a bike ride for like a week together. She also financially supported the work of Ezra Pound, and she also became an advocate of T.S. Eliot.
Yeah, these are all the greatest writers of the 20s. It's pretty amazing. I got to go back to that whole insinuation about two people taking a bike ride together. I'm sure that happens innocently all the time. I immediately was thinking about you. Somebody flips on Tour de France and you're like, oh my God, the scandal. Have they no shame? There's like 800 people out there. It's the greatest orgy.
Hey, if they're consenting adults, I'm okay with it. She also wrote a lot about the Bronte sisters. This Bronte love got her really into ghosts. And she went on to write a collection of ghost stories called Uncanny Stories, written in 1910. And this story is the first story in that collection.
Got it.
There are some illustrations by Jean de Boucherie, and we'll link to them because they're kind of neat.
Are they safe for work?
They are, unfortunately.
Good. No bicycles in there or anything like that?
No. She suffered from Parkinson's disease, and she disappeared from public life. Towards the end, she lived with her friend and housekeeper, Blorenc Bartrop. She passed away in 1946.
So let's get into it.
It begins with our protagonist, Harriet Lee, a 16-year-old who is meeting her love, George Waring, in an orchard. George has asked her to marry him. She has said yes, but her father says no. They have to wait 3 years. Unfortunately, he's off on a tour with the Navy and will be gone for 3 months, so they're going to have to spend some time apart. In this magical elderflower-scented place, she has to break the news to him that her father is making them wait. The writing is very lovely, and it has that heart-aching feeling of young, tender love.
And stupid love.
Yeah.
There's a little levity. It says, he's a perfect beast, George. He won't let us. He says we're too young. I was 20 last August, he said, aggrieved. And I shall be 17 in September. And this is my favorite part. He goes, and this is June. He says, we're quite old, really. How long does he mean us to wait? I mean, they're so impatient. 3 years is no big deal. And if you love each other, you should be able to do it. That 3 years will pass whether you're married or not. You know, it's ultimately reasonable what the father is asking for. Yeah. And in fact, quite smart, right? If he just puts it off, then they'll probably break up before then. If indeed it's meant to be, they will stay together. But of course, you as the reader, I'm reading this and going, he's going off to war and they had to put off their wedding. You know, I wonder what's going to happen.
Yeah, he doesn't return. His ship goes down in the Mediterranean and he is presumed dead. She is devastated.
In interesting moment because it says, Harriet said she didn't care how soon she died now. She was quite sure it would be soon because she couldn't live without him. And that's hyperbole from a 17-year-old.
Sure.
Sounds like that. But, you know, the truth is, she did kind of die a death when that happened.
Yeah.
This was it was that first time. I always think about, there was an Onion article about, it said, child begins lifelong battle with depression after losing helium balloon. You know, because it's like the first time something, things can go wrong, you know? And I think for her, this really shatters a vision of the world that she had as a young woman, and she never quite recovers from it.
So 5 years pass. Harriet is sitting in a pavilion on a beautiful tree-lined path. She's waiting for her new love, Stephen Philpotts, and she can smell elderflower, and she thinks of George and how she still loves him, even though she has this new love for Stephen.
Even this guy's name, it's like there's a giant gaping hole in her life now that George is gone. And who does she date? Stephen Philpotts. He fills the pot. Definitely intentional. Mm-hmm. An important detail, though, I thought was Stephen had asked her to wait for him there. It was the place he always chose to read his poems aloud in. The poems were a pretext. She knew what he was going to say. That was a little distracting for me because I'm thinking, I think what she means is probably that's the nice park bench they sit on. And then he opens up the poems he read for her. But it does say aloud. So I just feel like they're walking along having a conversation. And he's like, just 1 second. The flowers were golden. You know, all the passerbys are like, what? I'm sorry, this is just the place he reads his poems aloud. We have to wait for it to pass.
Oh. She sees Stephen coming to her, and he looks nervous. And she thinks, oh, he's probably going to propose to me, you know, because this is our special spot. And then he asks her if she knows about Sybil Foster.
And she's a little put off. I guess I know who that is. What about her? And he says, well, the thing you should know is that she's going to have me. Oh, Harriet, do you know what it's like to be terribly happy?
Oh.
She knew. She had known just now the moment before he told her. Oh. She sat there, stone cold and stiff, listening to his raptures, listening to her own voice saying she was glad. That is so rough.
Oof.
And she kind of didn't even want to marry him necessarily. It was like right before that moment, she was convincing herself it's okay to be with this person.
Yeah.
It's not cheating on my dead love because this is a different part of myself I'm giving to him.
Yeah.
I think that she dodged a bullet because this twit is totally oblivious if that's how he broke it to her.
Yeah.
I mean, this is like Bret Michaels on Rock of Love all over again for me to have to watch this. I mean, it's awful. Why would he tell her first that I'm getting married before saying, unless, you know, maybe the relationship wasn't as close as she thought it was.
Yeah. And she misjudged the way things were going. 10 years pass, and we now find Harriet living in a house in Maida Vale, a wealthy part of West London. Her father has been dead for 2 years now. She is 31. She's waiting for her new romantic partner, Oscar Wade. She had a fight with him and said that she didn't want to see him again because he had confessed to her that he was already married.
So now she's with a married man, and it's one of those deals where he says, my wife and I don't love each other. It's a sham marriage, but I have to keep it up for show because there's children, so very typical.
She knows it isn't right to continue the affair, so she had ended it.
Once she knew this, they had the big fight, and she rejected him. He left, beaten and ashamed, it says over and over. But for reasons she can't entirely fathom, she's called him back to her the next day.
When he arrives, we see he's a man about 40, a big man, broad-shouldered, eyes that are eager and animal. Very different from the soft poet types of George and Stephen. He takes her out to a restaurant in Soho to show her a good night out. She's thinking maybe they could just be friends, and he seems to agree. And that evening, he just drops her off at the gate of the house, and he doesn't come in. But they keep going out for meals together, seeing each other on the sly, and she knows that this whole thing is not going to last between the two of them.
It says she knew now what the end would be. And I see, I don't. And that's what's interesting about this. What she means is they're continuing to keep up pretenses that it's these dinners and things that they want to sneak away to. But she knows that this is going to go to the physical, that that's the only thing that it is.
Yeah.
I feel. It says she thought of George Waring and Stephen Philpotts and of her life cheated. She hadn't chosen Oscar. She really hadn't wanted him. But now he had forced himself on her, and she couldn't afford to let him go. Since George died, no man had loved her. No other man ever would. And she was sorry for him when she thought of him going from her, beaten and ashamed. It's that sense of, this is all I get, is this guy. And even the way it's written there that he'd forced himself on her is loaded.
Yeah.
He's not this poetic type that she's even attracted to, but he's the type that doesn't have a problem having an affair, and she feels like that's the only type that's available to her.
So one night, while they're eating in a private sitting room to keep away from the noise, he says, she tries to talk to him about books that she's reading about his field of work, which is engineering. But he doesn't want to talk to her about that stuff. He says, women never seem to consider that a man can get all the talk he wants from other men. Ugh.
Well, that's such a stupid thing to say because it assumes that she's talking in order to give him talk that he needs.
Uh-huh.
You know, the only reason she's talking is because she thinks he might need some talk. Not that you have anything to say or... Mm-hmm. It's just, this guy's terrible.
He's terrible. If they live together, he says, things would be better. But they can't, of course, because he's got a wife and kids.
Yeah.
She's like, oh yeah, the kids. Ugh. But maybe they could do the next best thing. They can go away together. He's got business in Paris, and she could stay with him at the hotel. And it would be 2 weeks together, alone, and they could find that bliss that they so desperately are looking for.
That she's looking for.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when he's saying we should just be living together, what he means is I should be able to get sex whenever I want, and we shouldn't have to deal with this. And that's why he's saying, well, then, you know what? Let's eliminate the distractions at least for a while by going to this hotel. Uh-huh. Going off to a hotel is on one side very romantic. But in this case, he really means we just need to isolate so we can get the deed done. And what she's struggling with is that it's an entirely physical affair for her as well. Yeah. I think that she's not attracted to him as a person, but I think that it's hard to know.
Yeah.
If this is a satisfying sexual relationship or not, but it certainly is something that she, on a level, wants and needs.
Yeah.
Just the physical intimacy. Mm-hmm. I think once they had it out that he's married and that this isn't proper, a bunch of the illusion that they are falling in love with each other fell away. It's getting closer to being more operational. And she is just searching for the thinnest evidence that it's more than that.
Sure.
That there's any, you know, because she can't forgive herself for being involved in a relationship that's just physical.
Yeah. They both got rooms in the Rue di Rivoli. For the first 3 days, hot, mad, passionate love. She looks at him while he sleeps. Sleep made him beautiful and innocent. It laid a fine, smooth tissue over his coarseness. It made his mouth gentle. It entirely hid his eyes. She likes him when he's sleeping, and she can't see his eyes. High praise!
It hides all of his personality when he's asleep,
yeah.
You know, and that's what she likes. There was a part earlier where she was trying desperately to be into his engineering business.
Yeah.
That's a tough one when you have to force yourself to be interested in something. It's like this Rachel Watches Star Trek podcast. I'm kidding. But the thing is about his business is it couldn't be more opposite than what she clearly likes. I mean, at least the other guy would spontaneously start shouting poems at people on the street. And she was embarrassed by that, but at least it was close to him being an artist, whereas this guy's an engineer who makes gizmos.
By the sixth day, she's just crying all the time. And Oscar says, it's just the low after the high of being so free to love in these first few days. But it's not that. It's boredom.
She was in love with Oscar and Oscar bored her. Oscar was in love with her and she bored him. At close quarters, day in and day out, each was revealed to the other as an incredible bore. And at the end of the second week, she began to doubt whether she'd ever really been in love with him. I had a friend, and I think I've described it before, who went through a relationship like this. He had been with a person for a long time prior to me knowing him. Mm-hmm. And she came into town for a weekend. They disappeared together and had their entire relationship in the space of that weekend over again. You know, it started out with them going, what? I haven't seen you in so long. Oh my God, it's the best. And then by the Sunday, they were like grocery shopping together and he couldn't wait for them to break. He remembered all the reasons they had broken up.
Yeah.
What they liked, I think, was connecting physically.
Sure.
And so there was a lot of dressing up that went on around that.
Now, when they get back to London, some of the passion comes back because of the thrill of sneaking around. And this goes on for a while until his wife gets ill and she might die. So what does this mean? Would they be free to be together? And they both feared that she would die and that they would end up together. They both were like, oh no, this can't happen. We don't want this. But she gets better. Whew. Big sigh of relief from both of them.
It says she stood between them and that permanent union, which they dreaded, and yet would not have the courage to refuse. Man, that's such an interesting love triangle, one in which all the parties don't want it to resolve. You know, it's like they want it to keep going because they hate each other. One thinks that maybe the wife as well.
Yeah.
It's possible that she's like, I'm glad he's preoccupied with something. Because he says sometimes that she knows about it.
Yeah.
There's just a sense of propriety, so it's not like she can move in with them or anything like that.
Well, finally, one evening, Oscar comes to Harriet and says, I think I'm going to settle down with my wife. He makes it sound like he's going to, you know, I'm going to propose to her. We're going to get married. Harriet says that all she wanted in their relationship was the clean, beautiful part. And he says, my part at least was real. It was cleaner and more beautiful than all that putrid stuff you wrapped it up in. You were a hypocrite, Harriet, and I wasn't. You're a hypocrite now if you say you weren't happy with me. And she says, I was never really happy. Never for one moment. There was always something I missed, something you didn't give me. Perhaps you couldn't. Because for you, love only means one thing. Everything that's high and noble in it, you drag down till there's nothing left for us but that. That's what you made of love.
It's a pretty real situation, what's going on here, and it's confusing for everybody. It all comes back to the wig. It was a good way to start off this month because the wig's tail, you know, on the head there, it's kind of in the correct anatomical place, the basal ganglia, the lizard brain there at the core, the primitive part of that brain structure that doesn't give a rat's ass for civilization or propriety or piety or any of these things. Mm-hmm. It just wants primal things. Mm-hmm. John Mulaney made a great joke about that recently because he had, you know, coming out of a stint in rehab, he says, when I'm alone, I realize I'm with the person who tried to kill me.
Mm.
I mean, that hits home. Everybody laughs at it, but why? And it's because we all recognize that even if you hadn't had such a traumatic incident.
Yeah.
We're all constantly at war with our baser impulses, trying to justify things that lizard brain makes us do. I always say the lightest touch version of it I think I've cited before is when I was in school and studying, and I would think, I should lay down and read this because I'll absorb it better if I'm relaxed. But I would have that thought and fall for it.
Yeah.
And then go over and fall asleep and wake up at 8 a.m. Oh my God, I didn't do my reading. So my body convinced me to do something and I just went along with it. I mean, how many times have you found yourself in that situation?
Sure.
You're like, wow, I just went to a lot of effort for something. And now that it's over, that's the kind of the thing that these guys are finding. That's the result of their relationship is they've made themselves miserable as a result of trying to justify these baser impulses with love. And his whole story that he's constructed. This guy's so full of it, calling her a hypocrite, trying to make it her fault now.
Of course. 20 years passed after that. Eventually, we're going to get to the ghost stuff. It's coming, folks. We find out that Oscar died 3 years after they split up into Harriet, this is a relief. The secret of the affair died with him. She looks back and thinks that it was so odd that she would have even had an affair. Her memories of who she was and is clash with the fact that she had an affair. She's like, I'm not that woman.
Yeah.
Now at the age of 52, she's gotten very involved with the church. She's become a helper to Reverend Clement Farmer.
It says her moments of excitement came when Clement Farmer, the lean, austere likeness of Stephen Philpotts, issued from the vestry in his cassock when he mounted the pulpit, when he stood before the altar rails and lifted up his arms in the benediction. Her moments of ecstasy when she received the sacrament from his hands. So this is another Thornbirds fan. She likes it. She settled into that sort of, I'm going to be the assistant to a person I can love from a distance, and that's that's good for me.
But she does take ill, and she is dying in her bed. Reverend Farmer is there with her in her final moments. He asks her if she's ready to die, if she has anything to confess, and she thinks about her affair with Oscar, but she decides not to share it. It wasn't necessary. For 20 years, he had no part of her life. No, she wouldn't confess about Oscar Wade. She had been guilty of other sins.
This part I actually found kind of comforting. It says, she received the sacrament. Now, he said, there's nothing to be afraid of. I won't be afraid if you would hold my hand. He held it, and she lay still a long time with her eyes shut. Then he heard her murmuring something. He stooped close. This is dying. I thought it would be horrible, and it's bliss. Bliss. Hey, in a depressing story, at least the dying was nice.
Yeah.
Something you don't mind hearing. Although there is a moment of agony in the end, of course, it says. And then she's dead. You know what? I thought that the ghost of this dude from her childhood was going to come back.
Oh.
I didn't know she was going to die in the middle of the story. This is like when they killed Sean Connery halfway through The Untouchables.
Right.
Totally unexpected.
Didn't see
it. But is she dead?
She lingered for some hours in the room where these things had happened. Its aspect was familiar and yet unfamiliar and slightly repugnant to her. The altar, the crucifix, the lighted candles suggested some tremendous and awful experience, the details of which she was not able to recall. She seemed to remember that they had been connected in some way with the sheeted body on the bed, but the nature of the connection was not clear, and she did not associate the dead body with herself. When the nurse came in and laid it out, she saw that it was the body of a middle-aged woman. Her own living body was that of a young woman of about 32. Her mind had no past and no future, no sharp-edged, coherent memories, and no idea of anything to be done next.
Hey, so at least she's got that Anne Rice hotness with her immortality.
Yeah.
She got young.
The room changes and she finds herself in a chapel of the church and she could hear an organ playing. She goes and kneels in a pew near the pulpit and she peeks, looking through her fingers, at the vestry for Reverend Farmer. He comes out and he's waiting for her. And so she goes to him and gets very close to him, so close that she can't really see his face. And then when she moves away, she sees the face of Oscar Wade. And then she feels afraid of him in that moment. She moves away, walking away from Oscar. But when she turns, he's gone. And she tells herself, Oscar's been dead for years. She's safe from him. I'm like, what? You're dead.
Yeah.
You're in the world of the dead now. What do you mean you're safe from him? That's crazy thinking.
To be honest, I still didn't get it yet. At this point, I hoped that some sort of backwards traveling was going to happen and that she was kind of in love with this reverend, so she's seeing him first.
Mm-hmm.
And then she's going to see her next lover, who would be Oscar from 20 years before. And maybe that's why she's the age of the affair.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking maybe she'll deal with some unresolved business with him, keep going back, keep getting younger, kick Philpott to the curb for not marrying her, get a redo that whole thing, and then maybe happily ever after with the first love.
All right.
Maybe she gets, you know, saves the whole ship. There's an action scene.
All right, yeah.
I didn't really think there'd be an action scene, but I did think that maybe she'd reunite with him.
Yeah, that would be nice, but she goes back further in time, you're right about that, to the arcades near the Rue de Rivoli, where she had her two-week sexathon with Oscar. She realizes that in this moment, she has no memory of the church and the reverend. So like her future is gone from her now. And she ends up at the door in front of the room in the Hotel St. Pierre. And she can hear Oscar inside moving around and she can hear him coming to the door. And so she runs away.
Aha. So I started to get it now. Oscar's, oh no, she's just, it's always going to be Oscar, isn't it? It's that kind of horror story. And this is all very, it's dreamlike. So naturally it's stream of consciousness.
Uh-huh.
But it is important that we should mention this before we finish the episode, that that's really what this author's famous for is she's the first person who articulated the stream of consciousness as a literary concept.
Mm.
And I remember learning about that in college. We were reading Mrs. Dalloway by Virginia Woolf, and I was really struggling with it because it was impressionistic and floating from bit to bit.
Yeah.
A little like this is, the definition of stream of consciousness now accepted is that it's a narrative mode that depicts the multitudinous thoughts and feelings which pass through the mind of a narrator. Mm. So it's not necessarily tied to reality, it's tied to what's going on in your brain. It was first used as a medical term, but in 1918, May Sinclair applied it to Dorothy Richardson's novels as a term to describe them.
Wow.
And that became, you know, Proust, James Joyce, Virginia Woolf, they all started using these stream of consciousness techniques.
Right.
She's the one that introduced that as something to be talked about in literature. So a big achievement on her part. This is not quite stream of consciousness since the narrator is a spirit in the spirit realm. There's a sense of the other to it, but the techniques of flitting from one impression to the next are very much the same.
Next, she goes into her memory to her father's death. Her father's body is lying under a sheet and she lifts the sheet to look at him, but it's Oscar. His eyes are closed and she thinks of that time when she watched him sleeping and loved him. But then his eyes pop open and they stare at each other.
The thing that she liked about him sleeping was that he wasn't alive. The eyes popping open is a totally horrific effect.
It is. She runs and the scene changes again. She finds herself in the restaurant that she frequented with Oscar and he's there waiting for her, but she can't see his face. He's holding up a paper or a menu or something. She sits and eats with him, but they don't speak. And after they eat, she goes with him up some stairs, which turn back into the hotel, into their room. And he says it's not over, that they must continue their affair forever. They're pulled together, but neither of them want to be together. And she drops to her knees and everything goes dark.
You know, I've cited it a million times, but the 80s Twilight Zone with Elliot Gould, where he was like a mean restaurant critic. And then he leaves the restaurant that he's at and it's a whole street of restaurants and he's so starving. He keeps eating at all of them and he never fills up. And then finally he gets a fortune cookie that says you're already dead. So this is like his punishment for being a jerk. And I love that one. This is just like that, except she's not a mean restaurant critic.
No.
She didn't do anything wrong. No. She just had her childhood robbed from her by tragedy, tried to fill a void that is unfillable, ended up getting in an affair with somebody who doesn't love her, and then died and has to, because of the sin of having an affair, now has to run into this dude over and over.
Now, she's back at the pavilion where she met Stephen, but of course, it's not Stephen. It's Flip and Oscar again. And she thinks back to that orchard with the elderflower blossoms and to sweet George there waiting for her. But when she gets back to that memory, it's Oscar Wade.
Oscar Wade is close enough to Oscar Wilde. Just once, I hoped it would be Oscar Wilde when she opened. He'd just be hanging out like, take a break, girl. Let's party. Let's go watch Salome. Something like that. Yeah. But no, always Oscar Wade.
She says, why do you interfere with my memories? He says, you think the past affects the future. Has it never struck you that the future may affect the past? In your innocence, there was the beginning of your sin. You were what you were to be.
What the hell does that mean?
I think he's saying that we are who we are throughout the course of our life, because if you weren't that person when you were 10, you could never have become that person when you were 30.
Right. Like, you couldn't be a sinner unless you were once innocent. So when you were innocent, you were really just starting to sin by being innocent.
You were setting up the sin. If you weren't that person, you could have never done those things that you did.
Sure.
I don't know if I agree with it, but that's what he's saying.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's like he's coming up. It's like even in the afterlife, he's coming up with really lame, head-confusing wraparounds to justify his bullshit. Nothing's changed.
Nothing has changed. She tries to get away, but finds herself in the hotel room again with Oscar. And she asks him, when will it end? When will we die? And he says, we have died. We're dead, Harriet. We're in hell, which is strange to me that she didn't realize that. But of course, in dreams, you often don't realize that you're dreaming.
Yeah.
And she says there can't be anything worse than this. And Oscar says,
this isn't the worst. We're not quite dead yet. As long as we've life in us to turn and run and get away from each other. As long as we can escape into our memories. But when you've got back to the farthest memory of all and there's nothing beyond it. When there's no memory but this. In the last hell, we shall not run away any longer. We shall find no more roads, no more passages, no more open doors. We shall have no need to look for each other. In the last death, we shall be shut up in this room, behind that locked door, together. We shall lie here together forever and ever, joined so fast that even God can't put us asunder. We shall be one flesh and one spirit, one sin repeated forever and ever, spirit loathing flesh, flesh loathing spirit, you and I loathing each other. Why? Why? She cried. Because that's all that's left us. That's what you made of love.
She then goes back to her earliest memory. She's a small child, and she's in a bright green lawn, walking through a garden path. She's back to the innocence of childhood, the safety of not having any memory, because her earliest memory, she doesn't have any memories before that. So
yeah,
there's the past can't interfere with her because there is no past. She's just existing in that moment.
At the bottom of the garden, there was a privet hedge cut by a broad path that went through the orchard. She knew what she would find there. Her mother was in the orchard. She would lift her up in her arms to play with the hard red balls of the apples that hung from the trees. She had got back to the farthest memory of all. There was nothing beyond it. There would be an iron gate in the wall of the orchard. It would lead into a field. Something was different here. Something that frightened her. An ash-grey door instead of an iron gate. She pushed it open and came into the last corridor of the Hotel Saint-Pierre.
So even when she tried to go back to that earliest memory, she winds up back at the cheating hotel, right? That's the conclusion. And I think that he had said in as part of this earlier that they were just going to go around and around till eventually it was just the two of them. You know what this reminded me of the most is Ben Cortman from I Am Legend. Mm-hmm. It's the doom of being trapped with somebody you really never had any affection for.
Right.
You know, the because that guy that he had to share that space with is the one who torments him. And so for her, it's the same thing. It's the guy who in normal circumstances, she never would have gone for.
Yeah.
But given what had happened to her, that was all that was available. And now you're stuck with that compromised choice, which is always just the very fear of life, is that you're going to get stuck in a compromised situation and then live out your whole life that way.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that that's the primitive fear that we have in a lot of, you know, you're not going to get what you want. You're going to get what you need, and what you need sucks.
Yeah. I also wonder about this, too. Is it saying that there's some supernatural force that is punishing her for her sin? Or is it her own guilt over what she had done that's forcing her to relive these things in her afterlife?
Also, like I Am Legend, I wondered the same thing. Yeah. So does she think that because she sinned, the power of that sin is internal? It's her. I committed this sin.
Yeah.
And so she can't leave that sin. She can't leave that affair with him because by her terms, that's the thing that's going to keep her from living an afterlife.
And, right, yeah.
And so until she frees herself from it, she can't ascend.
And I would lean to that because Mason Clare was agnostic.
Right.
So I don't think she believed in any force that would punish or bring punishment. I think it's maybe a story about kind of letting things go, letting your past mistakes go and moving on from them. Maybe thematically you can take that away.
I would take away from it when it said that he forced himself on her, that this is just another form of subjugating this woman mentally by making her feel like she sinned by being in love with somebody, by not having a pure storybook romance in her life, by having an affair and sleeping with somebody that's not her husband, by falling in love with somebody else who, you know, nobody has a lot of sympathy for the person who got dumped, you know? It's kind of like you get thrown into that class of, I guess in celebrity worship, it's Jennifer Aniston, right? You know, the part of her appeal is actually that another woman caused her to get thrown over. I think it's this sort of victim class that women get put into. Nobody puts a guy in that class. You don't ever hear about like, oh, poor Jake Gyllenhaal. Taylor Swift dumped his ass, you know? Nobody cares. And I think that there's a certain level of that here where such a head game's been run on this woman that she's torturing herself in the afterlife with it. Perhaps that's what it's about. Yeah. I, you know, I don't really know. I wouldn't. That's my perspective.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Making
it seems
guesses
to make sense. But yeah, I recommend checking this out. This is a really good story. I want to thank Rachel Lackey for being an exceptional reader. Again, since we've been recording, she's won the award again. This is her 10th award.
What?
It's amazing. She just keeps knocking it out of the park. So well done, Rachel.
I also would like to thank some of our patrons, and I'm going to start by thanking Pat Bevins.
I'd like to thank Caroline Michael.
Penda Tomlinson, thank you.
I know Penda. Penda's an awesome game designer and teacher at university. I'd like to thank Jake Medrano.
Jonathan Turner, thank you.
Tom Masonville, thank you.
Christina Swain, thank you so much.
David Sellett, thank you so much.
Sean Burnham, hey, what's up, Sean? Frequent reader. Thank you so much, Sean.
I want to thank John, and that's just J-O-N, spelled like my middle name.
Also the dude in Garfield, right?
Well, that's all the time we have. Thank you guys for joining us in our deep dive of this weird, creepy book from Jamie's attic. It's been a good run.
I think so, too. If anybody else finds a creepy book in their attic, let us know. Just the books. If you find other creepy things, we don't need to know about those.
Keep it to yourself.
Even if they're creepy things about yourself. Well, actually, I'm kind of interested in that. Thanks so much for tuning in, folks. I'm Chad Pfeiffer.
I'm Chris Lackey, and you've been listening to Strange Studies, The Strange Stories.
Exclusively on Patreon.
HPPodcraft.com.